From NPR News in Washington, D.C., I'm Neil Conan, and this is Talk of the Nation. Last night, President Bush acknowledged mistakes in Iraq, argued that failure would be a disaster for the United States, and announced plans to increase U.S. combat troop levels, especially in Baghdad.
Even if our new strategy works exactly as planned, deadly acts of violence will continue, and we must expect more Iraqi and American casualties. The question is whether our new strategy will bring us closer to success. I believe that it will.
We'll hear reaction to the president's plan from military and policy experts, from a leading congressional critic, and from you. Can it work? What's the alternative? What are the risks? It's the talk of the nation after the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. President Bush is taking a revamped Iraq war plan to the American troops today. He's in Fort Benning, Georgia, where he's promoting his case for sending more than 20,000 additional forces to Baghdad and Al-Anbar province to help put down sectarian violence.
Well, what's new about this plan is there will be enough troops to clear, build, and hold, and that our troops will be able to move alongside the Iraqis without political interference. And that's very important. It's important for our troops to hear, and it's important for the American people to know this is new.
Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice attempted to rally support for the president's plan on Capitol Hill today, but she encountered blistering criticism of the president's call for higher troop levels. Republicans, as well as Democrats on the Senate Foreign Relations Panel, told Rice that plan was a mistake. More from NPR's David Wellna.
Nebraska Republican Chuck Hagel gave Secretary Rice a thumbs down on the president's Iraq plan.
When you set in motion the kind of policy that the president is talking about here, is very, very dangerous. Matter of fact, I have to say, Madam Secretary, that I think this speech given last night by this president represents the most dangerous foreign policy blunder in this country since Vietnam, if it's carried out.
Rice insisted the president's plan is not an escalation, but an augmentation.
This is not a change in what we are trying to achieve. The Iraqi government needs to establish population security. What this augmentation does is to help them carry out their plan to get population security.
It was an argument that found scant support on the panel. David Wellna, NPR News, the Capitol.
Hundreds of potential jurors are filling out questionnaires regarding their views on a courthouse shooting in Atlanta nearly 2 years ago. The trial will take place in the same courthouse where the shooting took place. NPR's Kathy Lohr has more.
Notices were sent to 3,500 people in Fulton County in an effort to get a fair jury for the Brian Nichols case. The 35-year-old pleaded not guilty to a 54-count indictment where he's charged with murder, kidnapping, assault, and armed robbery. Prosecutors say after Nichols broke out of custody, he shot and killed a judge, his court reporter, a deputy, and later in the day, a federal customs agent. If convicted, Nichols faces the death penalty. Security is tight as jurors report for the first day of what's expected to be a selection process that could take up to 2 months. The 8th floor courtroom where the shooting began and where Nichols was on trial for rape has been cordoned off and has not been used since the March 2005 incident. Kathy Lohr, NPR News, Atlanta.
On Wall Street, the Dow is up 67 points at 12,509. This is NPR News. AirTran Airlines is upping the ante in its bid to buy Midwest Airlines. Supporters of the plan say the buyout would create an airline with more than 15,000 employees and generate earnings of $3.5 billion. Pat Duggins of member station WMFE reports.
AirTran Airlines says it will raise its current buyout offer for Midwest by 18%. That brings the deal to $345 million. The deal would include cash and AirTran stock, and it follows an earlier offer which was turned down by Milwaukee-based Midwest last month. AirTran is now appealing directly to Midwest stockholders who could sell their holdings for $13.25 per share. That's $2 a share higher than the deal that Midwest management rejected in December. This buyout deal isn't the only one attracting attention in Orlando. U.S. Airways this week increased its buyout offer for bankrupt Delta Airlines by 20% to $10 billion. Delta is the biggest carrier at Orlando International Airport, and the deal is aimed at winning over the airline's creditors. For NPR News, I'm Pat Duggan, Orlando.
Bangladesh's interim president, Eyajuddin Ahmed, has resigned, and the country's January 22nd parliamentary elections have been postponed. The announcement came hours after the government declared a state of emergency due to the recent weeks of deadly strikes related to the upcoming vote. A caretaker government, with Ahmed at the helm, was installed to ensure free and fair elections, but Ahmed's leadership triggered outcry from opposition leaders who accused him of being politically biased. NATO says its forces have killed as many as 150 insurgents in a battle in eastern Afghanistan. Today, the alliance said two large groups of militants encountered heavy ground and airstrikes when they crossed over from Pakistan. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, working to ensure that more students graduate from high school ready for college, work, and citizenship. GatesFoundation.org.
This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Last night, President Bush laid out a multifaceted new approach to the war in Iraq. He proposed diplomatic and economic initiatives and emphasized that Iraq's government must demonstrate its commitment to change or risk the loss of public support in the United States and in Iraq. But the central element of the president's plan is to increase American troop levels in Baghdad especially and to give those troops authority to go into parts of the city that were previously off limits.
Our past efforts to secure Baghdad failed for two principal reasons. There were not enough Iraqi and American troops to secure neighborhoods that had been cleared of terrorists and insurgents, and there were too many restrictions on the troops we did have. Our military commanders reviewed the new Iraqi plan to ensure that it addressed these mistakes. They report that it does. They also report that this plan can work.
There is considerable argument about that last point. Later in the program, we'll hear from Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois, who delivered the Democratic response to the president last night. But for much of this program, we'll speak with military and policy analysts, and we want to hear from you. Is the president right to focus on security in Baghdad and Anbar province, or is this too little, too late? Will Iraq's government meet its political and military commitments to the plan? Is there a workable strategy to deal with sectarian violence, to confront Shia militias, as well as Sunni insurgents? Are the risk of higher casualties worth it? And what are the risks of failure? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. We begin with retired General Jack Keane, former acting chief of staff of the Army. General Keane joins us from the studios of member station WUCF in Orlando, Florida. He's on the phone with us there. General, nice to talk to you again.
Good to talk to you, too.
You're among the intellectual architects of this plan. You, along with Frederick Kagan, wrote op-ed articles arguing for a surge of American forces in Baghdad in particular. Does the president's plan, is that your idea? Is this going to work, do you think?
Well, you know, from the military component, it certainly does. I mean, what we were advocating is a change of mission and definitely start to secure the population in Baghdad, which is an appropriate place to start, and that's what is going to take place. When we analyzed that, we believed we needed about five additional brigades to what's already in Baghdad and what the Iraqis can produce to do that, and the president has acceded to that. And you know, we thought we needed two regiments to go to Al Anbar. The military guys are saying one, and certainly we'll defer to their judgment. But by and large, from the force level perspective, I think it's on the money, and it's a force that can be decisive based on what it's being asked to do, and that is secure the population in Baghdad, but begin with the Shia Sunni neighborhoods where the population is about 1.8 million.
A lot of people, and I think you included, have said more troops are not going to be meaningful unless they have a clear and specific mission. Baghdad is a very big city. Is this mission clear and specific enough?
Well, you look at Baghdad, and like any military objective, I mean, you break it down into its parts, and you don't have to take on the whole city at once. And one of the things that we suggested is that the logical place to start is the Shia Sunni neighborhoods, because you can demonstrate an even-handedness in securing that population. And believe me, the military tactical feature of this plan is the troops stay in the neighborhoods 24/7 and not go back to their bases, which is a major departure from anything that we have done in the past, except for the operation in Tal Afar. So if you start with the Shia-Sunni neighborhoods and protect both Shias and Sunnis, I mean, it occurs to us that you have an opportunity there with Maliki for the first time to have some leverage over the Shia militias, both al-Sadr and al-Hakim, and also the Shia vigilantes, in seeking to get them back behind their barricades and accept that political accommodation, because we are finally protecting them. They waited 2.5 years in the harsh reality that, one, the Iraqis couldn't protect them, and the American military strategy chose not to protect them, and that's a fact. And I think there's something to work with there. And mm-hmm. if they don't accommodate that desire after the evidence that we're protecting hundreds of thousands of their people, then we may, in fact, have to deal with them in Sadr City. But I think the first step would be not to contest them in Sadr City, but to secure the Shias and the Sunnis in a mixed neighborhood. That's a logical place to start.
Well, let me play a tape for you. This was recorded earlier today at a news conference from the White House, where the new Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates, was specifically asked if this meant that the United States was going to either prepare to arrest or kill that Iraqi Shia militia leader, Muqtada al-Sadr.
I think one of the most important commitments that the Prime Minister has made is that in this offensive, the military will have the authority to go after all lawbreakers. There are no exceptions. I'm not going to hang specific targets on specific people.
That's Robert Gates, and referring to Muqtada al-Sadr, he later said that the troops would be going into Sadr City. Is not the kind of guerrilla house-to-house fighting that people were afraid of at the beginning of this war? Is that not going to increase American casualties?
Well, I believe what they're starting with is what I've been told is the neighborhoods that I suggested, the Shia-Sunni neighborhoods. Certainly, if they have to deal with Sadr City, a highly dense population of 2 million, the challenge you have there, I mean, it's military feasible to do that, certainly. But it is desirable. In my view, it's a second-phase operation, and only if you have to. Because what will happen is, quite frankly, that will unite the Shia militias who are not united now. That will unite the Jaish al-Mahdi, and it also will unite the Badr Corps and the vigilante groups, and the sum of that is about 70,000. And, well, I agree, Shia death squads are going to be killed in those Shia-Sunni neighborhoods if they're not brought to heel. They're going to be captured if we can capture them, and they're going to be driven out of there for sure. So in terms of the policy, the al-Qaeda, the Sunni insurgents, the Shia death squads, all of them are going to be treated equally, and all of them are going to be at risk if they're doing something they shouldn't be doing. And I believe that's what's really being said here. When and if we deal with Sadr City, I mean, that's a judgment I think is going to be made down the road.
Let's bring another voice into the conversation. Larry Diamond was an advisor to Paul Bremer and the Coalition Provisional Authority in Baghdad in 2004. He also advised the Iraq Study Group, which released its report last month. He's a senior fellow at Stanford University's Hoover Institution and the author of Squandered Victory, The American Occupation and the Bungled Effort to Bring Democracy to Iraq. And Larry Diamond joins us from a studios on the campus there at Stanford. Good to talk with you again.
Hi, Neil.
And what's your reaction to the president plan? Is this enough?
I think it's probably not enough, and it's definitely 3 years too late. I respect what General Keane has said. I think that there is some prospect that we can get stabilization on the streets in parts of Baghdad for a time with this. But I think this is only going to work if the political aspects that the president spoke to are really activated. And I don't see where our leverage is to bring about the painful political compromises that need to be made on the Constitution, on the sharing of oil revenue, on the reduction of the scope of debathification, and so on. If we're putting all of this forward at the beginning, before Iraqis have actually performed. The mistake that's been made over and over again, Neil, is that the Iraqis say they're going to do things, we say fine, and then we make our commitments. And then the Iraqis don't deliver, and then we have no leverage. So if Prime Minister Maliki is not able to bring about the kind of political reconciliation that everyone knows needs to happen and that the Iraq study group focused on in great detail, this plan has no chance of working.
You're describing a situation which occurred most recently last summer when U.S. forces were relocated from other parts of Iraq to focus on Baghdad. Iraqi forces promised for that operation did not show up. And again, the political concessions were not there as well.
Well, yes, let's talk about the failure last year following the sitting of the Iraqi parliament in April of 2006 to deliver on the promised constitutional reforms. The Sunnis swallowed the bitter pill of the constitution that was adopted in October of 2005 only because of the promise that there was going to be a comprehensive review of the constitution in a new constitutional review commission with an expedited process for adopting the necessary amendments. And the Shiite parties dragged their feet on this. The Kurdish parties dragged their feet on this. And nothing has happened so far. And there's a great sense of bitterness and betrayal among those political forces that were really not party to the drafting of the constitution that was adopted. And I don't think we're going to be able to get traction on the Sunni basis of the violence, on the resistance in Al-Anbar province, and it's radiating out into Baghdad. And I don't think we're going to be able to turn the corner on one of the most vital goals for the United States in Iraq, which is to really eliminate al-Qaeda as a presence in western Iraq in the Sunni areas, unless the Sunnis feel that they're getting a political stake in the future as well.
Let's see if we can get a quick question in from Paul. Paul's calling us from Winston-Salem, North Carolina.
Yes, I guess I listened to the speech last night. There's a couple of points. One is I really resented the president introducing 9/11 into the conversation last night because the mess that we have right now has nothing to do with 9/11. It has to do with the incompetency on the part of the administration. And I guess the question I would have is, how many of these 20,000 troops are actually going to be on the street? I would assume that a portion of them are going to be support people, whether they're...
Well, let's get a response from that from General Keane.
Well, the overwhelming majority of them, will be on the streets. I mean, the tactical commanders will make that judgment, certainly. But these are combat troops that are going in there, and they take some support troops with them. I mean, they have some engineers, and they have communications and the rest of it. The logistics troops that would support them are already in the theater. So whatever they bring with them are what we call in the military enablers to help the combat troops do their job. But the overwhelming majority of all of these forces are in fact, combat troops.
Okay, Paul, thanks for the question.
Last night, Paul,
I'm afraid we have to go to a break, but thank you for the call. Thanks for the question. We'll take more of them after we get back from the break. 800-989-8255 if you'd like to join us. Email is talk@npr.org. Our guests are Jack Keane, a former Army Vice Chief of Staff, and also Larry Diamond, now a senior fellow at Stanford University's Hoover Institution. I'm Neil Conan. This is the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking this hour about reaction to President Bush's plan to send additional combat troops to Iraq and to begin new diplomatic and economic initiatives in the region. Last night, the president made his case for the proposals. Today, on the floor of the United States Senate, Democratic Majority Leader Harry Reid blasted the plan.
The president, in choosing escalation, ignored the will of the people, the advice of the Baker-Hamilton Commission, and a significant number of top generals, two of whom were commanders in the field. In choosing to escalate the war, the president virtually stands alone.
We'll hear reaction from Senator Reid's number two, Dick Durbin of Illinois, a little bit later in the hour. Right now, our guests are retired General Jack Keane and Larry Diamond, who served as an advisor to the Iraq Study Group and earlier an advisor to Paul Bremer and the Coalition Provisional Authority in Baghdad. Let's see if we can get another caller on the line. This is Will. Will with us from DeForest in Wisconsin.
Yes. Thanks, Tom, for this program.
That's Neil, but go ahead.
Neil. Sorry about that.
It's okay.
Yeah, I'm a disabled Vietnam vet. Did two tours in Vietnam. And this ring exactly true to what happened during that era. In Iraq now, we do not have the hearts and minds of the people. And in this type of warfare, there's no way you can win it without that. And the people have a longer memory in that region than we have in this country. So what do we think we can do to get the heart and mind of the people other than some political move like this? And until that problem is solved, we will forever be losing people. After a move like this was made in Vietnam, it was another 38,000 names went on that wall. And it is ridiculous that a smokescreen like this is sent up to save face, which is exactly the same reason that the war escalated in Vietnam. It is ridiculous. Our young people should not be there doing this.
Let's
take the oath to defend the Constitution and this country. And that is not what they are doing in this.
Jack Keane, you're certainly old enough to remember Vietnam.
Sure, a Vietnam veteran, Batumi, the company commander myself. Listen, I welcome that question. In 1968, General Westmoreland was returned to the United States, and having executed a failed strategy, he was essentially conducting conventional operations against an insurgency. People recognized that it could not succeed. In came General Abrams. He took a completely different approach, remarkably similar to what General Petraeus is going to do here. He secured the population. As a result of that, the insurgency was defeated in 3 years. The problem was we squandered far too much time with the initial flawed strategy. There were still North Vietnamese divisions in South Vietnam, and the American people lost their support for that war, despite the fact the insurgency had been defeated by 71, and the House of Cards came down in 75, as we all know. But listen, when you talk about the hearts and minds, I mean, it's an overused term, but the fact of the matter is this basic operation is taking place in Baghdad's principal purpose is to secure that population. It's a proven counterinsurgency practice, the end result of which is to bring in economic packages and reconstruction packages so the people will be connected to local officials and indirectly to a central government. I mean, it's a tragedy looking back on it now that we did not do this many years ago. And the issue is it so hopeless that we can't pull this thing out?
Mm-hmm.
Well, my analysis and analysis of some others is it's not. It's hard, but it's not hopeless. And we certainly should put our shoulder behind it, given what the enormous consequences of a defeat in Iraq is, which is considerably worse than a defeat in Vietnam. But thanks for the question.
And Larry Diamond, is the analogy to Vietnam and to hearts and minds, is that appropriate?
Only partially. There's a natural analogy in Al Anbar province because there is a classic sort of, in a way, nationalist or radical insurgency there. But in the country overall and in Baghdad, increasingly, the source of the violence is sectarian and ethnic rivalry and violence by one group against another. And that was not really a factor in Vietnam. You've got two different types of violence in Iraq, and only one has a parallel to Vietnam. It's very hard to separate warring parties in a civil war as an external actor. And if we don't get a commitment by their political leaders to reduce the political drivers of that sectarian warfare, we just are not going to have nearly enough troops or nearly enough time to prevail in that. And that's why if this is going to have any chance of working, Neil, and I'm very, very skeptical, the politics are going to have to lead it.
Well, joining us now is Michael O'Hanlon, Senior Fellow of Foreign Policy Studies at the Brookings Institution. He was also an advisor to the Iraq Study Group. Michael O'Hanlon joins us from Brookings here in Washington, D.C. Nice to speak with you, Michael.
Nice to be with you, Neil.
And we heard just a moment ago General Keane talk about some of the consequences of failure. Let's listen to the way President Bush laid that out last night.
The consequences of failure are clear. Radical Islamic extremists would grow in strength and gain new recruits. They would be in a better position to topple moderate governments, create chaos in the region, and use oil revenues to fund their ambitions. Iran would be emboldened in its pursuit of nuclear weapons. Our enemies would have a safe haven from which to plan and launch attacks on the American people.
And Michael O'Hanlon, we've heard similar prescriptions in the past as part of this president's new approach. Is this a convincing element of his plan?
I think so. I think General Keane also made a good point a moment ago that the consequences of defeat in Iraq would be worse than those in Vietnam. But I also think that in some sense that begs the question. Just because you have a dire scenario that would result if we lost doesn't prevent you from losing. Simply saying that you're resolved not to lose doesn't guarantee victory. And while I do think that General Keane and others have put together a very good proposal, I'm more in Larry Diamond's camp of being skeptical that it can work at this late date. So I think it's incumbent on all of us, difficult for President Bush to articulate at this moment, but incumbent on all of us to start thinking about Plan Bs. Because while I do, on the margin, support the speech last night and the proposal put forth, I don't really expect that it will work. And so I think we need a Plan B, which to my mind should be something like the Bosnia model for Iraq, which is three largely autonomous regions with a weak central government, sharing the oil, but otherwise largely staying out of the business of most of the governance, and helping people relocate from one region to another to places where they will feel safer. I'm not sure it's right now the moment to do this, and clearly President Bush and Prime Minister al-Maliki don't think so. But 100,000 people per month are being displaced in Iraq. Bosnia is happening. Ethnic cleansing is happening. And pretty soon we're going to have no choice but to try to manage that process rather than pretend that our plan can stop it. So I hope very much I'm proven wrong. And I think this plan of President Bush's is worth a crack. But I think the chances of success are less than 50-50, and we'll need a backup plan, which I hope is a much better plan than complete withdrawal and concession of defeat. And I expect that we'll need that backup plan within a year.
And within a year, though the president is running out of time literally in his administration, and Secretary Rice on Capitol Hill today was talking about the Maliki government in Baghdad living on borrowed time. Do either of them have the political time to make something work, Michael O'Hanlon?
My guess is that the Congress is going to ask very tough questions and make a lot of comments. So, of course, you'll hear from Senator Durbin in a few moments. He'll probably say some similar things to what he said last night. But I don't believe the Congress is going to cut off funding even for the possible surge, even for the jobs program that I think is also an important and welcome piece of this package. My guess is that Congress is going to try to create a little bit of the tone that Larry Diamond and I are today, which is we will reluctantly support this even though we don't really expect it to work, and save the real showdown on policy for somewhere between 9 and 18 months from now.
Mm. Let's get another caller on the line. This is Britton. Britton with us from Reno, Nevada.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I was just curious, is it fair for the majority of Americans to think that President Bush's plan that he spoke about last night would work or not work due to the lack of information that we have as a populace? I mean, we don't have the information he has from his commanders or the intel or things like that. I mean, is it fair just to draw a conclusion if this plan will work or will not work just by him announcing it on TV?
Mm-hmm. I think the post-speech polling announced, I think, by the Washington Post was 61% of Americans polled were not in favor of the president's plan. Larry Diamond, is that a fair assessment?
I think that it's even higher than that. Yes, I think there's skepticism, but I don't think we're going to get to anything approaching a national consensus on some kind of strategy for extrication. And I think Michael O'Hanlon really articulated probably core elements of the most realistic Plan B if this fails, because it's going to have to be something radically different if this fails. I don't think we're going to get any kind of consensus on that unless we try this. What pains me, believing that it's likely to fail, is all the American kids who are going to die in the process. And let me say, when we put them right in the center of these nine districts in Baghdad and keep them there 24/7, we're going to take more casualties than we otherwise would have. It's a very risky plan. And we are likely to pay very high costs to try and make it work.
General Keane, is that right?
No, I don't think it is. I'll just make a couple of points I haven't been able to make before.
Sure.
I agree that the political part of this plan is probably the weakest part of it. And I'm also concerned about, you know, truly treating Iraq, you know, as a regional issue that has certainly global implications for us and also for the region. And the lack of articulation in those areas as to what the specifics of what we're trying to do, you know, I have some real concerns about. And I think the senior military leaders have always had some concerns. They have felt that the operation in Iraq was disproportionately military right from the outset. Now, admittedly, I think we know now this the military strategy was wrong, and certainly the military bears burden for that. But also, the relative ineffectualness of the other elements of our government has clearly played a part here, and we certainly want them to step up to the plate here. And I was expecting to get a little bit more specificity as to what that really is, you know, to gain confidence that we have a chance to bring the whole cloth together, so to speak. In terms of the risk of the operation, this strategy that we've been using to transition Iraqi security forces and running up and down the streets, conducting presence patrols, I think is really flawed. And we get into those neighborhoods and protect the people in those neighborhoods where we develop the intelligence networks. Over time, actually, we'll be a heck of a lot safer than running up and down the roads becoming targets. Will the casualties go up? Sure, the casualties are going to go up because if the enemy chooses to contest what we're doing, it will. But the evidence so far, based on what I've seen, the enemy's thinking about doing two things, conducting a heavier level of violence where we're not, and then avoiding us and just waiting us out. And that's why a short surge, so to speak, I cannot stand that term, but if an increased presence there for a short period of time is not the answer. This is an 18-month or two-year, in my mind, operation for Baghdad, but even more significantly for Al-Anbar, which is where we would have preferred to start, except the enemy chose Baghdad. Mm-hmm. And that's the basis in terms of the length of it. The risk of it, yes, I think there will be some additional casualties, but I think they will drop down rather dramatically from what we've been used to in the past.
Britton, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
And we're speaking with retired General Jack Keane, who you just heard, with Larry Diamond and with Michael O'Hanlon. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get Rob on the line. Rob with us from Baltimore.
Thank you.
Hi.
Hello. Yeah, I just had a comment. You know, I don't think any of these actions will be successful in Iraq because we're not there for the interests of the Iraqis. Our interests really are our own. We don't want a democratic Iraq because if we did, we would have an Islamic Republic of Iraq. I think that's quite clear. And your guests, Mr. Diamond, Mr. O'Hanlon, and General Keane, have all been great supporters of this war from the get-go. They've supported this administration, and I don't know why they would have any credibility in what they're saying today, and I would ask them to justify what they're saying today based on their previous support for the administration, which seems to have gotten everything wrong all along the way.
Mm-hmm. Can I just say, Neil, I did not support the war. I criticized it from the beginning. I said it was a mistake. I went to Iraq to serve in the Coalition Provisional Authority because we were already there, and I thought the mission was, and in fact remains now, figuring out what to do next, given that the war has happened. But I've been a very outspoken critic of the administration. I just don't think we should drown in our criticism and have that blind us from a sober and practical assessment of what to do next.
And Michael O'Hanlon, I think criticism is a fair word to use about much of your approach since the invasion began.
Yeah, but frankly, with all due respect to the caller, I think it's more important to get back to the future policy here because, you know, there's a lot of this kind of recrimination about who did what and said what. I have been critical, but I don't think that excuses me from having made a couple of mistakes along the way. But the more important question that I'm focused on now is raised by what General Keane just said. He thinks it may take 18 to 24 months to see some progress. I mentioned 9 to 18 months. I think we need to begin to develop a way of evaluating if the president's plan works, because my guess is that it will be approved approved or at least not opposed by the Congress to the extent that would be needed to prevent it from happening. So I think it will happen. And then the question becomes, at what point do we conclude that it has either begun to show some promise or failed? I would submit that while there may be certain metrics that take 18 to 24 months to improve, we can't wait that long to see a reduction in violence for the Iraqi civilian population. And if we haven't seen some progress within the course of 2007, I will be pretty close to concluding in my own mind that the strategy is failing. Now, I say that in a very preliminary way. I think that's a very important question that I haven't fully thought through in my own mind, but we're going to need to figure out metrics as a nation to know if this plan is working, and I'm very glad that General Keane has put his timeline on the table. Again, mine is a bit shorter, but I think this is a very important open question.
And at his news conference earlier today, Secretary Gates' timeline was even shorter. He said he expected to start getting information back within a couple of months in terms of how much the Iraqi government is willing to come through on its commitments as part of this plan. Is months, not years, a realistic goal for this, General Keane?
Well, I agree that we should see some progress, certainly, once we get on the streets and bring the level of violence down sometime in the summer. I was really talking about the completion of the operation would take about 18 to 24 months. I agree with Michael. If we don't see some progress here by the summer or the fall, then something's wrong, and we would certainly have to reevaluate it. But all the indication that I've had and the analysis we've done, we should certainly be able to see some of that. And I think the Secretary's concern, is a legitimate one. And we have to be honest here. I'm not sure, what this Maliki government is either. And I'm not certain anybody in our government knows for sure whether they truly want, a multi-sectarian government with the Sunnis represented in it or not, or they want to have a much more unilateral approach with overwhelming Shia majority carrying out the Shia objectives. I think that's an open question, and I believe what the president, I know the president has talked very tough to Maliki. I've been told that, and then I think the nation has, it's been implied to the nation, and I think that
I'm afraid we're just out of time. General Keane, thank you very much for being with us. We'd also like to thank our other guests, Larry Diamond of the Stanford University Hoover Institution and Michael O'Hanlon of the Brookings Institution. We'll have more on Iraq when we come back from break. This is NPR News. This hour, we're checking in with military and policy experts for reaction to the new strategy on Iraq that President Bush laid out last night. In a few minutes, we'll get the Democratic response from Senator Dick Durbin, and we want to hear from you as well. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. The president spoke last night. This morning at the White House, the Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates, and the Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice, spoke with reporters. And then Condoleezza Rice went to Capitol Hill, where she appeared before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, where she was asked by Chairman Joe Biden of Delaware, a candidate for the presidential nomination of the Democratic Party, who pressed her on whether and why she thinks she's confident that the al-Maliki government will come through with promises that it has not been able to come through with on the past. Here's Secretary Rice's response.
General Casey and our ambassador believe strongly that the Maliki government intends to live up to its obligations.
I'm asking you, Secretary.
I have met Prime Minister Maliki. I was with him in Amman. I saw his resolve. I think he knows that his government is, in a sense, on borrowed time, not just in terms of the American people, but in terms of the Iraqi people.
Are you confident?
I'm confident.
Thank you very much.
Joining us now is Aaron Friedberg, former National Security Advisor to Vice President Cheney, who now teaches politics and international affairs at Princeton's Woodrow Wilson School. He's with us from a studio on the Princeton campus. Good to speak with you.
Good afternoon.
And I wonder, are you confident that the al-Maliki government is going to be able to come through on the promises of men and political will that it made in promises to the Bush administration?
Well, I'm hopeful, but confident, I wouldn't say so. I think there's a lot of uncertainty about this. There's a possibility that it will turn out to be true. There are some reasons to believe that it will turn out to be true, but it's by no means a sure thing.
And if it's not, if it looks to people in Iraq that this is an attack on Sunni neighborhoods, on Sunni insurgents, and not on the Shia supporters of Premier Maliki, this does not promise well.
No, I think that's right. And that's been part of the problem up until now. The president alluded to this in his remarks last night, saying that previous operations had not been successful, both because of their size and because of limitations that had been imposed. And he's referring there particularly to limitations imposed on operations against Shiite extremists. So that will have to change and change pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm. Are the president's benchmarks that he's laid out for the performance of the al-Maliki government realistic? And in terms of enforcing those, Secretary Gates was asked about that. What if the Iraqis don't come through on their promises? And he said, we'll talk to them.
Right. It's not entirely clear what the leverage is. Now, it may be that the administration doesn't want to talk in a way that appears threatening at the outset of this. We're hoping that the Iraqi government will be cooperative. But it's also going to be a difficult problem if that's what begins to emerge. I mean, one thing about the way in which the deployment and the introduction of new personnel and new funds is going to be played out is that it's not going to happen all at once, which means that if it appears that the Iraqi government is not being cooperative, not living up to its obligations, then we may reconsider and change course.
Mm-hmm. Here's an email question we got from Glenn in Hayward, California. For many, the question has been whether Iraq is really the center in the global war on terrorism. It's certainly the place where the president has chosen to make a stand. Now, in response to tremendous pressure from Congress and the American people, he's concentrating his efforts on securing a single city and, to a lesser extent, a rural province in this region. This hardly seems to me to be a winning strategy in what the president has characterized as a global war.
Well, I'd say two things. One, whatever Iraq was before, it is now the center of this struggle. Certainly the people who were responsible for 9/11 and the people who have been responsible for acts of terrorism around the world since then are hoping very much that the United States will be humiliated and defeated and driven out. That there's no doubt that that would strengthen them in a variety of ways. And so I think we have to face up to those consequences. That's one of the reasons that I think we have to make this effort to make things work. As far as Baghdad and El Anbar province, Baghdad is the center of the country, and what happens there will determine what happens throughout the country. It's obviously the largest population center. It's the place, as the president pointed out last night, where most of the violence in the country is taking place. So if we're not able to secure that city, we're not going to succeed in the country as a whole.
Mm-hmm. The president perhaps has one last option left. This is it. He's been described as one of those poker players going all in on this plan. The al-Maliki government, we just heard Secretary Rice say, it's living on borrowed time. It, too, may have just this one opportunity. If there's just one chance left, is this the plan that they should go after?
Well, I think as far as the United States is concerned, yes, this is the all-in gambler. And as far as this administration is concerned, to get the kind of outcome that it's said repeatedly that it wants, it's not clear that there would be any way of getting there if this strategy fails. And we may be talking about the kind of plan B that Mike O'Hanlon discussed earlier. As far as the Maliki government is concerned, that's, again, a question mark. Do they, in fact, see this as the only way forward? Do they see their own personal survival at stake if this plan fails? That's not entirely clear. They may think that they have other options. They may feel that at this point they have the upper hand, or that the Shiites have the upper hand in Iraq, and that they can win if there's an outright civil war. If that's the case, then the situation is not going to improve. It's going to get worse. But I think we have to believe, and I do think there's reason to believe, that there are a significant number of people still in Iraq, Shiites and Sunnis, who are desperately hoping that that's not the outcome and trying to avoid it if they possibly can. Certainly there are plenty on both sides who would like nothing more than to have this apocalyptic showdown, but we're counting on the continued existence and resolve and capacity of people who are trying to avoid it.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with Aaron Friedberg, a former Deputy Assistant for National Security Affairs for Vice President Cheney, now a professor at the Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton. And let's see if we can get another caller on the line. This is Michael. Michael with us from Sausalito.
Yes, I have a solution and analysis to the situation. I can't help but think of the deal. First of all, number one, it is a regional conflict, not a local one. It's just being fought in the theater of Iraq. And the reason why we're in there and the reason for the fight is the oil, control of the strategic reserves there. So there's not going to be any resolve within the country itself as long as all the outside forces. All you need to do is pull gradually out, let everybody know, go and protect the oil fields, mothball them if you have to, and tell everybody that you'll wait and be ready and help, help try to negotiate the sides to let them figure out their issues on who's going to control the area, and then offer assistance and help and turn the oil fields back over. I'll take your comments off air.
Michael, thanks very much for the call. Is that a reasonable approach, do you think, Aaron Friedberg?
Well, I'm afraid I don't really think so. And first of all, I don't think that that really is why we're there. If we were only concerned about controlling oil, we would have proceeded much differently than we have up until now. I do think, though, that the caller raises an important point, and a number of people have touched on it, that Iraq is part of a larger region. And one of the interesting things about the president's remarks last night, although these points were buried to some extent in the speech, is that he does suggest a diplomatic approach, which is quite different from the one that was recommended in the Iraq study group, mm-hmm. at least in one critical respect. He says we're going to try to engage governments that we believe have an interest in avoiding the collapse and fragmentation of Iraq, presumably including countries like Jordan and Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states. And we're going to try to get them to do more than they have thus far to help prevent that from happening. But at the same time, we're going to be tougher in our approach to those states which we think have been trying, in fact, to encourage that outcome, namely Iran and Syria. So he's sort of taking half of the all-out diplomatic friendly approach suggested in the Iraq study group and saying we're going to reach out to friends, but we're going to give a warning to enemies.
Let's see if we get another caller on the line. And this is Pauline. Pauline with us on the line from Palo Alto in California.
Yes, hi. I'm going to interject something else in here that I've heard very little about except from a Marine who spoke on the NewsHour last night. My son is a Marine, and he's slated for a third deployment, possibly next week. And no one is really talking about, is this plausible with the amount of troops that we have and what's happening to our young men and women and what the ramifications down the road are going to be. And I am so upset, and this is what needs to be talked about. Everybody's talking about the logistics, and that's very reasonable and good, but the fact of the matter is that unless we have a draft, we cannot, this is not going to work with the troops that we have and sending them in like they're dish rags or kindling wood two, three, and four times and then extending their stay. And my son, I know, with a lot of the other Marines are just, they are so traumatized by this, and it is not going to work. It will not work. No matter, the best laid plans are going to fail. And it's also these young men and women are going to come back with a terrible sense of betrayal, which they already feel, from the military, for this country, from the president. And these are, like my son, he went in to serve his country, and they've really soured. And it's just, it's immoral, unethical, and it will not work, and we can't do this. These are our youth. They're human beings, and this is my son, and that's what I have to say.
Secretary of Defense did announce plans to increase the size of the Army permanently by 92,000 Army and Marines, but that's going to take several years, Aaron Friedberg, and the kind of relief that Pauline is looking for is not going to be the result of that.
That's absolutely true, and one of the tragedies of this, one of the many tragedies, I think, is that the decision to increase the size of our forces, which perhaps could have been taken shortly after September 11th, has not happened until now. If we had increased the size of our forces 4 years ago, we wouldn't be in the position we are now of trying very hard to scrape together relatively small numbers of troops to send them into this very dangerous situation. As far as whether it's going to work, I think I certainly believe that there's a chance that it can. I think the costs of failing are so large, and of course not only for people in the region, but in the long run for the American people, I think, that I do believe that it's a risk that we have to take. But I can understand people who feel that we've already paid a high enough price and don't want to see us pay yet more. Mm.
Pauline, thank you very much for the call, and we wish your son and his companions the best of luck.
All right. Thank you.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And we're speaking about reaction to the president's address last night. We had hoped to hear this hour from Dick Durbin, the number two person in the Democratic Senate leadership. He's reported to be still counting votes on the floor of the U.S. Senate and may not be able to reach us. In the meantime, we're still speaking with Aaron Friedberg, former Deputy Assistant for National Security Affairs in Vice President Cheney's office and now a professor at Princeton's Woodrow Wilson School. And let's see if we can get another caller on the line. This is Jeff. Jeff with us from Salem, Massachusetts.
Hi there. My question is, how do we expect different results when we bring our troop numbers up by 20,000 to where we were at this time last year when we were losing the war? I don't understand how that is a winning strategy. I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks so much.
Thanks for the call, Jeff.
Well, I think it's partly a question of numbers and also partly a question of how they're going to be used. It's 20,000, roughly 20,000 additional U.S. forces added to a force of about 15,000 U.S. troops that's presently in Baghdad, number that was increased over the course of the past year. The Iraqis are also supposed to commit additional forces to bring theirs up to about 20,000. So it's a fairly significant increase in the number of troops. But it's also a different strategy. It's intended not only to go after insurgents and those who are carrying out sectarian killings, but also to hold and secure the areas in which they've operated after they've been cleared. So I think it's a different strategy. Again, the question is whether it's going to work. The other piece of this, at least on paper, is an attempt to follow up more fully than has been done in the past with economic assistance to give people incentives and opportunities not to become involved in the insurgency and in the sectarian violence.
And at just about the last moment, Senator Durbin has been able to reach us by telephone from the U.S. Capitol. Senator Durbin, good to speak with you again.
Good to be with you.
Are Senate Democrats and you are going to try to block funding to send these extra troops to Iraq?
Well, that, of course, is a second stage of this. The first resolution is likely to be a sense of the Senate resolution next week on this strategy. We have an indication that more and more Republican senators will join us in voting against the strategy. I think a strong bipartisan vote sends a very powerful message to the White House.
And if not that vote, then there would be a follow-up vote on what Senator Kennedy suggested?
There are several opportunities after that vote for approaches that deal with the number of troops, the time that the troops will be allowed to rest and stay with their families before they're reactivated, even funding questions. But I do want to underscore the one thing that's been said repeatedly. The Democrats that I've worked with here want to make certain that the troops in the field have all the resources they need. We are not going to cut back on any appropriations to deal with the safety of the troops in the field. We want them to perform their jobs effectively and come home.
And further on to that, will you act to ensure that no further troops are sent into the field?
Now, that, of course, raises the point that Senator Kennedy's amendment would address, whether the president would have to seek a specific authorization to increase the number of troops beyond a certain level. That is one of the options before us. Senator Feingold is entertaining another one. What I'm saying is the first resolution is the one where we do have, I think, a strong chance of bipartisan support. The next amendment that we might consider is still being debated. We don't know what that will be.
And very briefly, Senator Durbin, we know you spoke last night after the president. We heard Harry Reid, the leader, speak today. Is the Democratic leadership united is the Democratic Congressional Party united to oppose this?
Well, of course, there may be a dissenter or two or three within our ranks of 51. But I would say the overwhelming majority of the Democrats in the Senate oppose the president's policy.
Senator Durbin, we thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us. We know you're very busy up there.
Thank you.
Dick Durbin of Illinois, the number two ranking Democrat in the United States Senate. Also, we'd like to thank Aaron Friedberg, former Deputy Assistant for National Security Affairs in the Vice President of in the office of Vice President Cheney, now at the Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton University, for his time and being with us earlier today. Much more coverage, of course, later today on NPR News. Stay with us. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington.